Would you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditation of all of our hearts be acceptable unto you, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. I want to begin this morning by telling you a story, which is actually two stories, one right from history and the other from fiction. In his novel Les Misérables, Victor Hugo begins telling the story of Cosette with an oddly detailed and philosophical description of the Battle of Waterloo. Now, for those of you who don't know the story of Les Mis, Cosette is an unfortunate young girl whose mother, compelled by her own sickness and poverty, was forced to leave her in the custody of a greedy and immoral couple who run an inn, Monsieur and Madame Thénardier. Under their care, poor Cosette is abused terribly, beaten and starved, forced to perform heavy labor in the inn. And when the main protagonist, Jean Valjean, finally comes for her after her mother has died, she is found shoeless, dressed in rags, and in terrible health. It's with then some relief and satisfaction that as the story unfolds, Valjean becomes a surrogate father to Cosette, and she is placed in the loving care of a convent in Paris, growing into a beautiful young woman and ultimately marrying the virtuous young man, Marius Pontmercy. It seems odd, then, that Hugo begins her story with the lengthy discussion of the Battle of Waterloo, where Napoleon was finally defeated in 1815. He begins by recalling that the fighting that day could not start until 10:30 in the morning because it had rained the night before and Napoleon couldn't move his artillery until the ground had dried enough. He recalls how Napoleon, his guns now in place, began a savage attack of the British lines, relentlessly sending wave upon wave of attacks for over 3 hours. He describes how by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the British were beginning to falter, and in desperation sent out a cavalry charge, which was totally routed by the French. He explains how at this point, an exalted Napoleon saw his opportunity to finish off the British, and at around 4 o'clock, sent his own cavalry in a countercharge. This is when the famous square formations of Wellington's armies braced for the oncoming charge. However, as Hugo reveals, this charge of French cavalry actually spelled the end for Napoleon, for his cavalry on the right charged unknowingly into a sunken lane, which the French had been unaware of. The French cavalry crashed into the ditch and perished under their own momentum, and the British squares were able to hold the line. And it was at that moment that a Prussian army, allied to the British, arrived on the battlefield to reinforce them. The French were routed, and Napoleon's army was destroyed, and Napoleon was finally dethroned as emperor of his French realm. And now Hugo finishes his harrowing tale of Waterloo late in the night after the battle. A shadowy figure is looting bodies in the lane where the French cavalry met its demise. And though he is a deserter and a thief, this looter ends up pulling a wounded officer to safety, saving his life despite having robbed him of all of his belongings. And in the dark, the two exchange names. The thief's name is Thénardier, and the soldier's name is Montpercy. And we can see now that Hugo has told the story of Waterloo as a way of showing how seemingly unrelated events on a cosmic scale create connections and outcomes for the lives of an individual. In this case, the life of Cosette is caught up in the consequences and outcomes of Waterloo. In time, the thief Thénardier becomes her abusive keeper, and the man that Thénardier saved in the battle is the father of her future husband, Marius. And if those two had not met in the aftermath of Waterloo, Cosette's future would have been very different. Montpercy would have died, thus having no son for Cosette's future husband-to-be. And Thénardier, had he not been a deserter and a thief at Waterloo, he may have lived a very different life and been unavailable to provide the care that Cosette needed, even in the horrible manner in which he did. What is more striking, though, is that in his account of the Battle of Waterloo, Hugo also sees this working of cause and effect in the downfall of Napoleon himself. Where you and I see the workings of chance in the Battle of Waterloo, Hugo sees the hand of providence. Had it not rained on the night of June 17, 1815, he writes, the future of Europe would have been different. Providence needed only a downpour of rain to bring about the collapse of a world. Had the ground been dry that day so that the artillery could move, the battle would have begun at 6 a.m, and it would have been over by 2-3 hours before the Prussians could arrive to tip the scales. And more, part of Hugo's story recalled the fact that when Napoleon surveyed the terrain prior to the battle, he asked a French peasant if there were any obstacles of note in the area of the sunken lane that the cavalry fell into, and the peasant simply shook his head. Hugo concludes, it can almost be said that the shaking of a peasant's head was the cause of Napoleon's downfall. To the question, was it possible for Napoleon to win this battle? Our answer is no, because of God. It was time for that great man to fall. Napoleon had been impeached in heaven and his fall decreed. What Hugo is describing here in the story of the Battle of Waterloo and in his story of Cosette is the concept of providence. Very simply defined, providence is the care and guidance of God over the creatures of the earth, especially in directing the universe and the affairs of humankind with wise benevolence. It's really the idea that God is deeply and specifically invested in directing the outcome of our existence, both on a cosmic and social scale, as well as in our individual lives. In short, he cares about what happens in the world and in our lives, and actively works for our good. This is providence. And more than that, providence is not simply about the provision of our needs, like food and shelter, friends and family. Providence is about God working to ensure that his creation remains just and good, again, both on a large scale in the world and in our individual lives. Hugo quite correctly, I think, sees that God worked for the good of the whole world in unseating Napoleon, as well as weaving together the specific events of people's lives for the benefit and good of Cosette. Purging the world of Napoleon's evil, this tyrant whose delusions caused the destruction of whole countries and the loss of countless lives, was the same story that led to Cosette's life being preserved and ultimately vindicated in a happy life with Jean Valjean and Marius. I think this is really important for us to remember on Thanksgiving, that what we are celebrating today is not simply that God has provided us with what we need to live, though that is certainly true, but it is also important to remember that God's provision is actually caught up in his providence. Sadly, this is something that the modern mind has been trained not to do. We have been trained to see the universe in deist terms, where God sets the universe in motion and then steps back, uninvolved and unconcerned for what happens on earth and in our lives. We've been taught it's the laws of nature that direct outcomes, not God. And even as Christians, this perspective often taints our thoughts to the point where we unconsciously acknowledge that God perhaps charges up nature to provide for our needs, but only occasionally acts to change the particular outcomes in creation and in our lives. I can remember the first time I read Les Miserables and how unnerving it was to read Hugo's thoughts about Napoleon's downfall and that God had orchestrated its happening. God was responsible for Napoleon's end through a rainstorm and a confused peasant? That just sounded crazy. But the truth is that my reaction demonstrated just how modern I am in my own thought processes. For the church of the past has always affirmed God's deep and particular interest in creation. From the most general in scope, where he's concerned about nations and cultures and peoples, to the more specific events and choices that each one of us make every day. Take, for example, the angelic orders of the ancient and medieval church, which seem so foreign and strange to our ears. By the High Middle Ages, the church classified the angelic hosts in an elaborate arrangement that explained their place in God's providential ordering of the universe. There were 9 orders of angels, 3 sets of 3. At the top, there were thrones and seraphim and cherubim. and they ordered heaven into a place of worship under God's sovereignty and justice. These are the angels that worship around the throne of God, crying, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord of heaven and earth." The next set of three were called virtues and dominions and authorities. And they govern creation itself, ensuring that it operates according to the ethical and moral laws of God, ordering everything from the course of the stars and the seasons to the definition of right and wrong in human hearts and minds. And finally, the last order of angels are principalities, archangels, and angels, which we're most familiar with. And their work is to guide and direct nations and peoples and institutions. So the principalities begin by ordering those larger groups, nations, whole institutions, countries. And then archangels are given to specific missions to uphold the world. And angels are assigned to us, you and me, and specific people for their guidance and protection. To our modern ears, this all sounds very odd. But these angelic beings represent God's providence. To the mind of the historic church, God is so deeply involved in the world that he has established armies of angelic hosts to be active in creation and to ensure that the nations and peoples and institutions, and as well as individuals, are guided toward a good end. In fact, the provision of our physical needs is secondary to the greater concerns of providence. We see this very clearly in a couple of our readings this morning. In our first lesson, we have Moses reminding the people of Israel of how God's provision is part of his providence. "The Lord your God," he reminds them, "is bringing you into a good land, a land with flowing streams, with springs and underground waters welling up in valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive trees and honey." No question, Israel will be cared for from God's abundance in the land. But then Moses is also quick to remind them that this was all part of God's larger providence, which manifests itself in their exodus from Egypt and their wanderings in the desert. "God did this," he said, "to humble you and test you, and in the end, to do you good." God's providential priority was their transformation from slaves to a royal priesthood, and they ought to remember and align their attitude of thanksgiving to that priority, in addition to being grateful for their blessings. And Jesus, too, in the gospel reading this morning, shows a similar concern. As he travels through the region of Samaria, Jesus heals a group of 10 lepers, one of which is a Samaritan, and he returns to thank him. Jesus' frustration with the other 9 is that they who were Jews did not realize that their healing was not just an act of provision for their physical health, but an act of providence. For as Jews, the other 9 should have recognized God's providence working in Jesus, his Messiah. They should have, through their healing, recognized that the Messiah had come to them to bring the kingdom of heaven to pass in their lives. What circumstances and events and decisions in their lives had mingled and coalesced into that single moment when they found themselves in the presence of Jesus? How did they not recognize that God had orchestrated that moment for them in their lives? And that's the real challenge for us, I think, to recognize providence when it appears in our lives. At best, we miss it, and we're just confused by it. And those moments were a bit like Forrest Gump, who said, "I don't know if Mama was right or Lieutenant Dan. I don't know if we each have a destiny or if we're just floating around accidental-like on a breeze. But maybe I think it's both." In these moments, we are like those 9 lepers, grateful for the healing, but missing the Messiah. And at worst, we can feel abandoned. We can feel like God has left us to make it on our own and that the events of our lives are nothing more than random happenings. We miss the meaning and significance in our own stories. We miss seeing how God is working in the smallest details of our life to produce transformation and purpose and redemption. We need to learn to see again, with different eyes, eyes looking for God's providence, working through his provision, but also in many other ways. And like listening, looking, and seeing are skills that we can develop. We can practice them and we can get better at them. The catch, though, is that often when we look, what we see is influenced by our expectations. As I said earlier, as modern folks, we already are influenced by the notion that God is only working in the background. But I also think that we are swayed by the unfounded notion that when God works, we will only see it in the fully miraculous or cosmic activity. We're only looking for Waterloos. Not that there can't be Waterloos in our life. They do sometimes appear as God's providence swirls and coalesces around us. Sometimes he does drop manna from the sky or break open a spring from a rock. But more often than not, God's providence is simply evident in the small things. American writer Annie Dillard is a master of seeing and looking. And in her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, she writes, "I've been thinking about seeing. There are lots of things to see, unwrapped gifts and free surprises. The world is fairly studded and strewn with pennies cast broadside from a generous hand. But, and this is the point, who gets excited by a mere penny? If you crouch motionless on a bank to watch a tremulous lip ripple thrill on the water and are rewarded by the sight of a muskrat paddling from its den, will you count that sight a chip of copper only and then go your rueful way? It is dire poverty indeed when a man is so malnourished and fatigued that he won't stoop to pick up a penny. But if you cultivate a healthy poverty and simplicity so that finding a penny will literally make your day, then since the world is in fact planted in pennies, you have with your poverty bought a lifetime of days. It's that simple. What you see is what you get." In short, we must stop looking for our Waterloo moments and look for the pennies strewn about in our life, and we will see God working and guiding us by the hand of his providence. The other obstacle we face is that we assume that God's providence is manifest only in the good things in our lives. But if you look at closely at Cosette's story, the truth is that God's providence was working in both the abysmal care provided by the Thénardier and the blessings of the convent and her marriage to Marius. Sadly, we would be tempted to argue that God's providence was only found in her life with Jean Valjean and Marius, but the fact is that without the Thénardier, as awful as they were, she would have died because her mother was too poor and sick to provide for her. And more importantly, and this is what we don't think of, God's providence is working in the Thénardier's lives too. They have the opportunity for redemption in their care for Cosette, should they choose to look with different eyes as well. You see, each moment that God's providence is working in your life, whether in the good or in the bad, in COVID even, it is an opportunity for redemption and good for to come to pass. God's providence can and does work through both for everyone. It just takes eyes of faith to see God's providence working in the bad as well as the good. Today and tomorrow, most of us will be sitting with family and friends celebrating Thanksgiving. One common tradition that sometimes happens is that as we eat our turkeys and all the trimmings, we go around the table and share what we are thankful for. This year, I challenge us to look with different eyes at our lives and not only look for God's provision, which will surely be there, but also for his providence. I pray that we can look and see God working in our life so that we come to know him and experience his good purposes. I pray that we can see God working in both the good things and the bad things, knowing that he cares about the smallest and most insignificant details of our lives, and that he is working through even planning and arranging all the circumstances of your life to conform your soul to the image of Christ. I pray that we can recognize that in God's providence, anything is possible, and that in that moment, we can truly say, thanks be to God. Amen.